Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, welcome to the Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, and I greet you to another edition of our program, and I hope that you will have a great week. This is the Monday morning edition of the Cross in the Desert, right here where I live in Florissant. It is absolutely gorgeous, beautiful, summer-like weather, and it seems like we have finally, for a long time, put that heavy rain and flood behind us, and it's just a good day, a good week here. I hope wherever you're at in the world, in the internet world, and that you're having a good day as well. Today on the Cross in the Desert, have a lot to accomplish, going to be taking a close look at the upcoming Iranian election, which is just a few days away, and going to have a close, intimate, up-close interview with Atna Farghahandi. She is the political cartoonist that was imprisoned in Iran, and she's going to share her testimony of what it was like in prison. Plus, we will also continue the reading of my new book, Finding Hope and a Future. I want to begin this morning by talking about the Iranian election. Many people who live here in the West have some kind of a strange, I guess, insight into elections, thinking somehow that this election coming up kind of mirrors our democratic process, that Iranians do have some freedom when it comes to electing their next president. Well, nothing can be further from the truth, and I'm going to have some help to prove that this morning from a good Facebook friend. His name is, and I'm waiting for my page to come up here. He wrote an article here lately called Iranians Farce Presidential Election. His name is Slater Bakhtavar. He's my Facebook friend, and he's a foreign policy analyst, a political commentator, and author of Iran, the Green Movement. And we're going to have a little bit of help from his expertise to talk about really what goes on every 4 years cycle in Iran, because they put on a good show, trying to give this image that they are somehow a democratic process when it comes to presidential elections. As I mentioned, nothing could be further from the truth. And so what I want to do this morning is spend a little time reading his article and giving you some insights into exactly what goes on there about every 4 years. Well, we're going to get this right yet. My computer wants to load and wants to do strange things, and now it wants to play a video. I'm going to put that on hold. On May 19th, 2017, Iran will hold elections to determine, among other office holders, the nation's president. Hassan Rouhani will be seeking another term, having taken the presidency in 2013. Rouhani faces a wide field of potential opponents, including Mustafa Mir Salim, Mehdi Kazali, and Ibrahim Raisi, none of which, of course, is particularly important information, since Iran's upcoming election and every presidential election held in that country since 1979 is a farce. Western media are bafflingly enamored of extolling the virtues of Iran's free and democratic electoral process, seemingly oblivious to the fact that it is neither. Anyone holding naive notions of any and all Iranians having some unalienable right to submit their name for election, then have a fair and equal chance to earn votes through rigorous campaigning and the debate of ideas, would do well to abandon such lofty fantasies, writes Slater. In theory, any Iranian citizen of at least 21 years old and who is a good Muslim and professes belief in God, this is mandatory, can register for the presidential election. The democratic process, however, is largely arrested from there. After registrations are complete, the Guardian Council, one of the real stations of power in Iran, reviews the entrants and decides in its sole authority whom is to be permitted to run and whom denied. The council does not publicly discuss its reasons for barring candidates, but effectively anyone of insufficient religious orthodoxy, anyone who is viewed as politically threatening or radical by the ruling theocracy, or without exception, anyone who is female, is not allowed to stand for election. The actual voting process is riddled with fraud, too. The government meticulously plans initiatives to transport poor people whose political leanings are known beforehand to the polling stations, and official government employees are essentially ordered to vote. Tactics such as these allow officials to report enormous voter turnout numbers, pleasing journalists and maintaining the facade of Iran's democratic international image. The president of Iran has extremely limited political power anyway, and is mostly a figurehead for public consumption and mollification. His existence as an elected official allows foreign and domestic media outlets to portray Iran as some manner of free society, but real power rests almost exclusively with the supreme leader. This man is above even the Guardian Council, and if he so wishes, he can, and typically does, invite the council to select candidates of his personal liking. It's a shame that so many people attribute so much importance to Iranian elections and to the identity of the president, as neither of them are of any great importance. For years, the Iranian people, who do not approve of this broken, undemocratic system, have sought help in achieving a truly free society, especially from the West in general and the United States in particular. Unfortunately, under the previous American administration of Barack Obama, those calls fell largely on deaf ears. Obama ignored social strife demonstrated by the Green Movement, a protest born of another rigged, farcical presidential election. Embarrassingly, he paid Iran's government a $400 million ransom for prisoners and even negotiated a disastrous nuclear deal with the nation's theocratic dictatorship. There have been some encouraging early signs that current U.S. President Donald Trump, who may be more sympathetic to the Iranians and their plight as he has expressed a desire to engage more with the real people who live there than the government under which they suffer. Of course, the American media firmly opposes this humanitarian stance as disruptive and is set to blame Trump's snubbing of the Iranian government for any hardline presidential candidates that the Guardian Council may choose to authorize in response. President Trump is correct of the Iranian people, both morally and pragmatically. It has always been the right thing to do to support these oppressed people as they increasingly seek reform and formation of a freer society. But now, in the 21st century, the timing is perfect. New technologies exist now that allow communications on a wider scale than ever before, enabling the proliferation and exchange of new ideas and ways of thinking. Free thought is a danger to Iran's theocratic regime as it is to all dictatorships. These technologies are to be encouraged among the people of Iran, and those people should be afforded the dignity and respect of being addressed directly, not through their tyrannical rulers. Fortunately, President Trump seems willing to afford them this respect and is unlikely to negotiate directly with their government. He is also unlikely to engage in a war with Iran, which would accomplish nothing but to hurt the Iranian people with little hope of unseating their government. The solutions to the problems in Iran are peaceful and readily available, and it's time to implement them now. That is a wonderful piece written by Slater Bakhtavar on Forbes about this upcoming so-called Democratic election, which, of course, it is not. And I want to help you understand what is going on behind the scenes there. I want you to hear this very recent interview that Fox News's Eric Schahn did with Reza Pahlavi, who is president of the National Council of Iran and also the son of the former Shah of Iran. I want you to hear this interview in which he lays out what he believes is the important future of the Iranian people. Let's listen.
Eric? Well, as President Trump prepares for his first overseas trip later this week, with Israel and Saudi Arabia among the stops, a major worry that will be raised in both nations is the continuing threat from Iran. In our exclusive interview, one prominent Iranian, the exiled Prince Reza Pahlavi, predicts the regime in Tehran, he says, will collapse just like the Soviet Union after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the liberation of Eastern Europe. He told me that in Iran, the power is with the people.
The regime has been given enough chance to come clean. It hasn't, for good reason. And therefore I say, forget about this regime, think about the people.
He is the oldest son of the Shah of Iran, the monarch who once ruled his nation. Now, Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi is fighting for the soul of Iran. During his father's time, Tehran was a reliable ally, and America was not the great Satan, as the theocratic regime in Tehran now calls us. The monarchy, led by Pahlavi's father, was overthrown by the 1979 Islamic Revolution of Ayatollah Khomeini, and Pahlavi's family fled the country. Now, he wants the Iranian people to rise up against the regime and establish a parliamentary monarchy based on democratic values, freedom, and human rights.
What I'm calling upon is a process of civil disobedience, which is a method of change. How? By bringing domestic pressure on the system. If enough people refuse to cooperate, like Indians did in India during the British time, when they can paralyze the system by massive sustained labor strikes across the nation, that's not people shooting bullets in the streets.
So what you're calling for is a revolution from within.
I think the mechanism of change can be by nonviolent civil disobedience, provided that it is nurtured and cared for. History is full of such examples. Nelson Mandela was rotting in his cell in South Africa while half of the world was doing business with the apartheid regime, until a point where people in the world said, basta, enough. It is no longer acceptable.
And how does that happen when it comes to your country?
Well, I think that the American people, as far as America is concerned, the Europeans, the people in the region, the more they hear about what the Iranian people demand, not what the regime wants, what the Iranian people demand, they will in turn tell their would-be congressmen or senator decision makers, what are you waiting for? These people are like us. They don't want to come here and destroy us or blow us to pieces or wipe a country from the map. They want to be like us.
He says there are spontaneous protests and unrest against the regime that could spread with world support, unlike 8 years ago.
Back in 2009, when the people took to the streets, the Green Revolution, do you think the West and President Obama could have done more?
Well, if the people on the streets are holding up slogans in English or in French, if they're not practicing their linguistic skills, they're sending you a clear message. They were chanting on the streets during the Green Movement, Obama, Obama, Yaba Una, Yaba Ma, which in Farsi means either you're with them or with us. Make a choice. I think the choice was not to heed the call of the people.
The focus has been too much on the regime, in your view.
Yeah.
Do you also think that too much has been given to the regime in the past?
Well, every time the regime had its back to the wall, somehow they were thrown a life vest and were able to basically catch their second wind, as we say here.
For example?
Case in point, the nuclear deal.
That deal is supposed to stop Iran from building a nuclear bomb. But critics charge it has only enriched the regime to support terrorism and simply delays Tehran's inevitable nuclear program. Pahlavi has dedicated his life to opposing the regime and its extremism.
You have spent decades fighting this. One would think that you'd be pessimistic, that you would not have hope. But I hear you optimistic and that you have hope.
I always have hope. You know what? Because it's the nature of humans. And there's one common point in every person anywhere on the planet, regardless of their nationality, religious, religion, or ethnicity. And I think it's a trio of three obvious factors. One is freedom and the ability to speak your mind and believe in what you want. The other one is an opportunity to participate in whatever system that is governing your country. And last but certainly not the least, dignity, human dignity. And when they deprive you as a human being for any of these, will you give up and not stand up and fight? It's a historical conclusion that these kind of regimes simply cannot survive. It's just a matter of time. The only question is how soon and at what cost.
Do you feel in your heart that one day this regime will fall?
Absolutely. There's no question about it.
Well, if some have faulted the Shah's rule and U.S. policy at the time for creating the conditions that led to the Islamic Revolution, the prince says in this day and age a secular democratic state can be established. And he says he has faith, especially in the young Iranians who are connected to social media and the Internet. And in a letter to President Trump, he asked for Americans' help, saying, quote, support the brave people of Iran in their quest for justice. And by the way, you know, the Iranian presidential election will be held there next Friday. The prince says its results will not change the regime's behavior.
A very insightful interview. I want to thank Eric Shawn from Fox News for having the opportunity to sit down with the prince. I know that over a year and a half ago, he was a guest right here on my radio program, The Cross in the Desert. I really enjoyed his insights. He has real hope that the Iranian people will definitely rise up and that one day, very soon, a secular democratic state will be in place and overthrow this dictatorship regime. He's a very intelligent man. He is very committed to the people of Iran, and I really wish him well in his endeavors. And I stand with Reza Pahlavi and the National Council of Iran as they seek to have this kind of state and society achieved very soon in Iran. And I believe he's right. The young people are fed up with the fruit of religion, false religion, and what it's done to their Persian homeland. And I believe that this young group of people, these millions of young people, will not stand for this much longer. So I'm praying for my Iranian friends that very, very soon they will truly have the freedom to believe and to think without a dictatorship hanging over their head. Reza Pahlavi, National Council of Iran. Well, speaking of dictatorship, I want to talk to you about my next guest. She truly is a very amazing person. Her name is Atina Farghandi. She's a political cartoonist, and she has spent over a year being tortured in prison for simply drawing a cartoon which was speaking out against a rule in Iran that they were going to take away the right of sterilization of women. And she thought it was absolutely wrong to do this to women. She believed that women have control of their own bodies, and she made a caricature of the parliament to decide to do this and put it on her Facebook page. And as a result, she suffered much in prison. And she's an amazing, amazing lady. And I want to read to you an interview that's from July of 2016 when Atna just got out of prison. This is from Michael Kovna of the Washington Post. I want to give credit to him. I'm going to read you this interview because I thought it was very insightful. Just recently, I uploaded a podcast from Amnesty International where Atna is talking in depth about her imprisonment. I highly recommend that you listen to this. I put it on my Facebook page. It is shocking and revealing. But I want you to hear this interview from Michael Kavanaugh of the Washington Post with Atna Farghahandi. First off, Ms. Farghahandi, let me just say, now that the opportunity finally provides, congratulations on your freedom. We heard reports about the difficult conditions while you were imprisoned. How are you feeling and doing? And how does one ever recover from a mental and physical ordeal such as yours? Here is Atna. I appreciate all your efforts you and your colleagues have made so far. My feelings at the moment are not very pleasant because it's like I'm stuck in a limbo. Obviously, the mental weariness of imprisonment is more serious than the physical problems caused by it. At the moment, since I've arrived at the certainty that there is miracle lying in the art of drawing and painting, I'm more determined to continue doing it forever. While I was in prison, I wasn't aware of outside events and the news about me, especially in 2015 when I was on a hunger strike in the gruesome Gorbachev prison. At that point, I was absolutely hopeless and thought I would die there without my voice ever being heard. But I kept going with the strike, constantly thinking that even if I die, I have a clear conscience, for I've died for my beliefs and goals. After my appeal to be transferred to Evan Prison was approved and I ended my hunger strike, my attorney, Mr. Mohimi, gave me all news in two very short visits, boosting my morale and giving me hope. When I heard my sentence of 12 years and 9 months imprisonment, I thought it was unbelievable and very unjust. Since I was 29 at the time, I calculated that I'd be in prison till I'm 42. At first, I had a hard time accepting the sentence, but then I thought I could use this time as much as possible to draw and have an opportunity to put an exhibition of my works after my release. I considered prison my home for the next 13 years. My family could not accept this new attitude of mine towards prison and my beliefs, and at times they were frightened by it and wept. At these times, I had no choice but to make faces for them behind the glasses in visitation cabin to make them laugh. These were the hardest and most bitter days I had during my incarceration. Why do you think you were ultimately awarded your freedom? What swayed the legal system? Atna. As a result of the efforts made by my family and my attorney, Mr. Mohimi, and pressures from the international community and human rights organizations, my sentence was reduced from 12 years and 9 months to 18 months and a 3-year suspended sentence for insulting the Supreme Leader of Iran. I am grateful to all those whom I don't know and to whom I owe my freedom. Is there anything about your case, including the reported virginity test after shaking your male attorney's hands, that we should know about that we might not know? Yes, that's caused a lot of confusion. Considering the fact that my family had refuted that I was tested for virginity and pregnancy because of shaking hands with my lawyer, people wanted to know the truth. Well, the truth is that my family was in denial at the time because of the dominant traditions in the Iranian culture and fear for more pressure from the judiciary on me. But the tests were actually made, which led to my 3-day hunger strike and objection. The The Islamic Republic of Iran later confirmed this event. It is noteworthy that both my attorney and I were exonerated from the adultery accusations, and I owe this to the judge of this specific case who issued our exoneration verdict independently and neutrally in spite of the sensitivity of the case and security pressures. What are you making now, and will your art remain political, or might you steer your art and activism in a different direction? Atna, right now I'm painting and making a collection of artwork with political and social contents, and I intend to have an exhibition within a year, but I'm afraid I can't hold this exhibition in Iran, and I'm even thinking of having a street gallery, though it wouldn't be without consequences. I believe that criticism serves art, so I have decided to use my art to challenge social issues as I've done before, like the cartoon I drew after I was released as an objection to the dean of Al-Zahri University who expelled me and many other students. Do you feel safe now in Iran? And can you ever see coming to visit America? Of course, I could be more successful in developed countries, but when I witness the problems Iranians are dealing with, such as economic and cultural poverty and various limitations, I cannot leave them alone to live in another country in a better situation, despite all the constraints and the issues I would possibly face. Many Iranians, though, have had to leave their homeland because of these constraints, and have been active outside of their country to improve human rights in Iran, and are successful too, but I don't see it in me to be able to leave my country because of my emotional attachments, which is perhaps a weakness of mine, but as long as I live, I will stay here, even if I have to go to prison again. Are you comfortable with being a symbol for artistic resistance and political freedom of expression? I don't consider myself a symbol. I simply acted on my thought, beliefs, and principles, and I think all people have an individual and social task to fulfill. Is there something I didn't ask that you would especially like to tell our readers and listeners? Yes, one of the things that has had a destructive impact on me after my release was the incarceration in the gruesome Garchak prison, which is for prisoners with all sorts of non-security crimes. What bothered me the most was to see inmates, many of whom were victims of economic and cultural poverty in the Iranian system, who were not treated like human beings. Their most basic rights were violated. I consider Garchak prison as a graveyard of time, where time dies. I sometimes see those inmates in my nightmares. Once I saw one of them collecting and braiding my fallen hair. I see myself as a reflection of other people, and to respond to this question of yours, I would like to reflect the wishes of other women in prison in Garchak. Most of them longed for cool drinking water instead of the salty, lukewarm water they had to drink from the tap. There were only 4 showers in each chamber for 189 inmates, with the same salty water for only an hour a day, so many of them missed a shower. Most of them condemned to death sentences, wished to plant something that wouldn't wither from the salty water, and to see that plant, to leave a living mark before departing from this life. What an amazing interview from the Washington Post and from Michael Kavna. I really appreciate this article. It gives you an insight into who Atna is. One of the things that struck me about this interview was that is not like other Iranians. She feels an obligation to stay with her people in Iran, to support them, to be a voice for them within Iran. That is very courageous. She could have an opportunity to have her artwork displayed in countries like here, where there would not be consequences. But this is a woman who loves her country in spite of the difficult challenges, who loves her people in spite of the dictatorship. I really, really respect this lady for her courageous freedom, for the way that she stands up for her people. Well, we're going to get ready now to talk about one refugee who left her country. I'm continuing the reading of my book, Finding Hope and a Future. But before we do that, I want you to hear this beautiful song of worship from Christine DeMarco and Bethel Music. It's called It Is Well. right now on the cross in the desert.
Yeah.
Well, the beautiful worship song of Karen DeMarco and Bethel Music. And I seem to have lost the picture on my computer for some reason. I hope we're still live here, but that's never happened before. But I want to continue reading from my book, Finding Hope and a Future, Maral's Journey to Freedom. And let's listen. Shamim focused her total attention toward the hanging punching bag, dangling a few feet in front of her. She closed her eyes and took a long, deep breath. And I'm going to just pause here for a second. And find out what exactly. Okay, we're okay. You have things that your computer does to you that takes you by surprise, and it signed me out for some reason. Don't ask me why. It's the miracle of technology. Let's continue with the reading of the book. This is from Finding Hope and a Future, Maral's Journey to Freedom. This is Chapter 3, entitled A Broken Bridge. Shamim focused her total attention toward the punching bag dangling a few feet in front of her. She closed her eyes and took a long, deep breath. Then a few seconds later, she lunged forward and perfectly executed a roundhouse kick, striking the center of the bag with a tremendous thud. "Bravo, bravo," Maral shouted with the clapping her hands. Shamim smiled back at Maral and leaned forward over her knees, gasping for breath. For the last 6 weeks, she had worked hard to achieve the beginning skills and moves of Kung Fu. Shamim was Maral's most exceptional student, and today she was very proud of her achievements. It had been a very hard workout, and they were both sweaty, tired, and exhausted. Shamim began wiping off her face and hair with a towel and then looked back at Maral. "After we shower, can you please drive me to the plastics factory for a job interview?" Maral gazed at the clock on the wall. It was almost noontime. "Sure, I have a couple extra hours to spare today." "Thanks, dear friend," Shamim replied, patting Maral on her shoulder. Maral and Shamim undressed in the locker room and took a long, cold shower together. Quickly changing clothes, they both reluctantly put on their hijabs and got into Maral's black Peugeot car for a short drive to the factory, which was located outside of the city limits of Shiraz. Pulling into the parking lot of the factory, Maral found a suitable spot a few feet from the building. Shamim quickly exited the car for fear that she was going to be late for her interview. Maral walked closely behind as they both entered the front door and arrived at a small waiting room. Sitting behind the desk, busy answering the phones, was a tall young man with short black hair and brown eyes. Maral couldn't help noticing his big nose as he slammed down the phone in anger and then rolled his eyes with frustration as it began ringing again. Finally, after another long conversation, the young man rose up from behind his desk and introduced himself to Shamim. "Good afternoon. My name is Ali. Please come this way." Ali escorted Shamim through the side door while Maral took a seat a few feet away from his desk. The phone began ringing again, and a few seconds later, Ali returned and ran toward the desk, quickly picking up the phone. Maral shook her head and took a deep breath, very thankful that she didn't work at such a busy and stressful environment. After Ali finished talking on the phone, he hung it up and leaned back in the chair, exhausted. Then after a few moments, he glanced over toward Maral. "Forgive me, it's so busy here. Were you interested in filling out an application too?" Ali's question took Maral by surprise. Her face turned red from blushing. "No, I'm sorry. I'm not interested. I just came here to bring my friend." Ali frowned with disappointment and then got busy with some paperwork. 20 minutes later, Shamim emerged with some papers in her hand, rejoicing that she had just been hired. Maral hugged her best friend, and together they quickly left the factory, returning to the parking lot. As she approached her car, Maral suddenly stopped with a frustrated look on her face. She had mistakenly parked too close to someone's car, and there was no room for her to back now. "Oh, Now what do I do? Maral sighed with frustration. Suddenly, a young man emerged from behind the car. It was Ali again. When he saw Maral's car, he burst into laughter. Kind ma'am, could you please move your car so I may leave for my break? Maral was embarrassed and quickly agreed. Ali followed her around to the driver's side door. Are you sure you don't want to fill out an application? We desperately need a secretary to answer the phones. Our secretary is on vacation, and I've been filling in for her. Sorry, I don't have the experience, Maral explained. Besides, I'm too busy at university, and I also teach students kung fu. Ali leaned his head through the car window and looked intently into Maral's eyes. Don't worry, I can train you. And I promise you will be paid well. Please, just try it for a few weeks, and if you don't like it, you are free to leave. Ali's persistence and charm was having a profound effect on Maral. She looked back up at him, and this time his nose didn't look so big. She saw him in a different way now. He was handsome, charming, and funny. Finally, after a long debate, she gave in to Ali's pleading and decided to take the job. Ali was true to his word. He patiently trained Maral and taught her proper phone etiquette. For the first few days, Maral felt a little overwhelmed, but Ali always seemed to calm her back down with his jokes and funny facial expressions. At one time, Maral did not have a good opinion of Iranian men and the way they controlled their wives, but now Ali was changing that opinion. For the first time in her life, she was seeing an Iranian man who seemed to actually care about women. While Ali seemed to be fun and easygoing, his father was completely the opposite. Haji Javed was a strict Muslim man, almost like a dictator, and very devoted to the Islamic faith. He made sure that he traveled once a year to Mecca for a pilgrimage. Whenever Ali would be talking to Maral alone, in another room, she could see the fear in his eyes. Ali would look in both directions to make sure his father was not somewhere close by. According to the Islamic faith, it was forbidden for a single Muslim man to ever be alone with another woman unless they were married. Maral had just begun learning the basics of being a secretary when Haji Javed paid her a personal visit one day while she was busy answering the phones. She could see the bitterness and anger in his eyes as he handed her a sum of money. Here is the money that you earned. Take it and don't come back. Haji then quickly turned his back and hurried out of the office. Maral stared down at the money and took an angry deep breath. She was enjoying her new job, and now suddenly it had come to an abrupt end. She put the money in her purse and waited for a few minutes, hoping Ali would come into the office, but he never showed up. Maral was convinced that his father didn't like her. In his mind, she was not Islamic enough for his son. Maral spent the next few weeks in a depressed mood. Relationships with men never worked, and now she was determined to continue teaching, which was the passion of her life. However, one afternoon, her life took another dramatic change. While at the bank, she unexpectedly ran into Ali again. She was convinced that he was forever gone from her life, but somehow he had an amazing way of reappearing again. Ali was thrilled to see her and had a very guilty look on his face. I want to apologize for my father's behavior, Ali explains. It's not your fault, Maral said, interrupting. I understand. Ali was relieved. He had a relaxed look on his face. I'm so happy to see you. I missed you, Maral. Ali nervously cleared his throat. What are you doing this weekend? I don't have any plans, Maral answered. Have you ever seen the garden of Afafabad? Ali excitedly asked. No, I haven't, Maral responded. Ali drew closer to Maral. His eyes were beaming with joy and excitement. Would you please be my date this weekend? Saturday was a beautiful sunny day, a perfect day to visit the gardens. Stopping by an ice cream stand, Ali purchased two chocolate cones and gave one to Maral. Maral quickly began licking her cone, enjoying and savoring every bite. Chocolate was her favorite flavor of ice cream. Ali seemed very content and relaxed as they walked together, marveling at the Historical Weapons Museum and touring the Royal Palace. As they exited the palace, Ali could sense that something was bothering Maral. He stopped walking and looked with concern into her brown eyes. "Maral, what's wrong? Aren't you enjoying yourself?" Maral breathed a heavy sigh. She had an embarrassed look on her face. "No, no, it's not you, Ali. I love our time together. I'm just afraid of us being caught by the morality police. Your father would be so upset with you." Ali shook his head in disgust. "I know what you're talking about. Let's not worry about it, Maral. I'm just so happy that we can be together." Since the revolution, Sharia law demanded the segregation of the sexes. As a result of the law, it was forbidden for two single people to go out publicly together on a date. If they were seen by the morality police, they would pull them aside for questioning. Quote, "What is your relationship between the two of you?" The police would ask for identification, and if it was determined that they were not married, they would be put under arrest and taken to the police station. Their parents would be notified, and a bail would be set. Dating between two single people is considered a crime in Iran, and the incident would go on both of their records. After the first date, the relationship between Maral and Ali grew stronger. They had to hide their relationship from their parents and resorted to keeping in touch by cell phones. Maral only had a small flip phone and had to spend over 1 million tomans to purchase a monthly SIMS card. Although Facebook was now the worldwide social network, it was filtered by the government, and it was too expensive for Maral to buy VPN software to unfilter it. Twice a week, Maral would meet Ali after her kung fu teaching class for an hour. They decided not to date anymore for fear of being caught by the morality police. However, there was another hurdle that they both had to climb over, and that was hiding their relationship from Maral's brothers. One afternoon after kung fu class, they both met together at a local restaurant for a chicken dinner and were shocked by an unexpected visit from Muhammad. Maral tried to remain calm and nervously introduced Ali to her brother, and she could tell right away that he was not happy. Unexpectedly meeting her brother at the restaurant struck fear into Maral's heart, and she reluctantly decided to break off her relationship from Ali. However, Ali fiercely objected, and he came up with a plan to smooth over the family differences. Driving to the gym, Ali decided to surprise Maral's brother and have a heart-to-heart talk with him. Instead of meeting Muhammad, he ran into her other brother, Farshad. Farshad was busy working out and practicing his kung fu moves. Watching Farshad slamming his foot into the punching bag with perfect roundhouse kicks was very intimidating. Reluctant to meet Farshad, Ali quickly left the gym and instead called Muhammad on his cell phone. He nervously expressed his desire to marry Maral. After a long conversation, Muhammad surprised Ali with a blunt answer. "That's Maral's decision if she wants to marry. That is her choice." Talking with Muhammad left Ali with a renewed sense of hope and courage. Rendezvousing with Maral at their usual meeting place after her kung fu teaching class, Ali decided to be honest with Maral about his troubled past. He admitted being married before to a 19-year-old girl and explained that he was forced by his family to marry her. Maral was shocked and demanded for Ali to tell her everything. She was satisfied that Ali had been completely honest with her. Maral bolstered up the courage to finally tell her parents. Shada was shocked and outraged when Maral explained to her Ali's past. "No, Maral, you cannot marry with this man." "But Mom, he's very kind," Maral pleaded with her mother. "Don't judge. Please meet Ali." Taking an angry deep breath, Shada reluctantly agreed. "Okay, bring him to me." In Iran, if a man desired to get married, it was customary for him to bring her candy and flowers when meeting with the parents. When Maral saw Ali being greeted at the door by her mother, she was mesmerized by how handsome he looked, dressed in a blue plaid sport shirt with a button-down collar, neatly pressed black dress pants, and a navy blue suit jacket. After saying his hellos to Mokhtar and Shaida, Ali rushed over to Maral and presented her with a small bouquet of red roses and a box of assorted chocolates. Maral gave Ali a warm smile and put the fresh red roses up to her nose. "They are beautiful, Ali," Maral said with a twinkle in her eyes. She was so happy that Ali had a real romantic side to him. Her sister Farinak was busy preparing the tea. For this special occasion, it was also customary for the future bride to serve the tea, but Maral was not one to follow customs. She boldly told her sister before Ali's arrival, "Custom is not my boss." Since she was a child, the poems of Ferdowsi had taught Maral to fight and rebel against all traditions and customs. Growing up independent and free-spirited was something that Maral had learned from her father, and even though she was about to become married, Maral had vowed to remain steadfast to her principles and not become the slave to a man. Throughout the evening, Ali explained his previous marriage to Maral's parents and his desire to be an honest husband and a good provider. Shaida felt uneasy when she learned about Ali's previous marriage and wanted assurance that he would be faithful to her daughter. "How do we know that you will never go back to your former wife?" Shaida's question made Maral feel extremely nervous and uneasy, but Ali immediately reassured them that he would never do such a thing. "I love Maral. I want to make her happy," Ali promised them. A few weeks later, it was Mokhtar and Shaida's turn to visit Ali's parents. Returning home after a long evening together, Mokhtar took Maral aside and aired his objections to the marriage. He didn't like the way Ali's parents boasted of their riches. Wealth seemed to be the center of their life. Mokhtar was offended that they didn't refer to Maral as their daughter, which was customary to do. They instead referred to her as Miss Maral instead of daughter. "I don't have a good feeling about this marriage," Mokhtar confessed to Maral. Her brother Muhammad felt the same way but was leaving the decision up to Maral. "Maybe in the future our problem will be solved. I'm marrying Ali, not his family," Maral proclaimed. Despite her family's objections, the night before the wedding ceremony, Ali brought Maral a beautiful gold necklace with his name written on it, along with a gold wedding ring, and presented it to her. The next day, on February 8, 2004, at the age of 21, Maral walked down the aisle in a white wedding dress with a silver crown of diamonds atop her black hair and said yes to Ali, becoming his wife. Just a few months earlier, she had sat with her best friend Shabnam on the banks of the river at her grandfather's farm, discussing the future about marriage and children. And now today, that girly discussion had turned into an incredible reality. But was Maral really prepared to face the grim and painful reality that was awaiting her? And that ends today's reading. We are still reading in Chapter 3 of my newest book, Finding Hope in a Future, Maral's Journey to Freedom. Our next video broadcast, I will continue reading in Chapter 3, A Broken Marriage. It has been a real pleasure to read this book to you. I often think that the best way for you to appreciate what I write is to hear it. And my dream is one day for my books to all become audiobooks. That is a big challenge. But I hope today that you have begun to see a little bit more about what life is like in Iran. Maral reluctantly, and I think in many ways, agreed to this marriage. I think deep down inside, she knew what her father was saying was true. Now, Maral has that very free-spirited, independent stature to herself. And yet, she found something in Ali that gave her hope about Iranian men. And although I've read in this book, and you've heard me read, how independent and against tradition and customs Maral was, I think that she decided to give Iranian men a chance. I think that she felt maybe her future would be much brighter. But she didn't listen to the counsel of her father. Her father knew the way his family was and the way they treated her that this was wrong. But Maral said, no, I'm not marrying Ali's family. I'm marrying him. Well, on our next read, we're going to find out just how true her father was and how right he was. And his wisdom, she rejected it, but he loved his daughter enough to give her that freedom to choose, something that you don't have much of in Iran, the freedom to choose. We will continue this book reading on our next radio broadcast. It has been a very rich day. I'm glad I was able to share with you the insights into the Iranian election and what that really means, and also spending some time sharing with you a little bit about Atna Farghahandi and how she survived that harsh and difficult prison sentence. And so I hope that you've enjoyed today's broadcast and you've learned a little bit more about Iranians and their desperate fight and plight for freedom. And as always, I will continue to be faithful to bring you a broadcast of the truth about what happens behind the scenes in Iran and the dictatorship and how it destroys the lives. And I will also share with you the good news of Christ. So thank you so much for joining me today on the broadcast. I will see you this Thursday on the next Cross in the Desert. Have an incredible week.